Welcome to today's edition of SCOTUSCast, the Federalist Society's podcast providing analysis on current cases of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm your host, Haley Reynolds, and our expert today is Supreme Court Advocate Eric Jaffe. Mr. Jaffe is former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. His complete biography is available on the SCOTUSCast page of the Federalist Society's website. For the past decade, Mr. Jaffe has managed his own practice, where he has been frequently sought out for his appellate work in a wide variety of areas. He has authored over 60 briefs for the U.S. Supreme Court alone, many of them in landmark cases on issues ranging from federalism and medical marijuana to school vouchers, campaign finance, and race-based admissions policies. Since our last edition, the Supreme Court has issued 3 decisions, which are summarized briefly on our SCOTUSCast page. Mr. Jaffe will focus on the most recent 2, a court's power to determine whether Pennsylvania is a proper forum for disputes between a Malaysian company and a Chinese company before considering its power over the parties or the case, and Colorado voters' ability to challenge a congressional redistricting plan they allege was improperly instituted by the court, calling itself the legislature. And now, here is our expert, Eric Jaffe.
Hello, good day, and thank you to the Federalist Society for asking me to participate in this edition of SCOTUSCast. Today I'm going to talk about 2 opinions handed down by the Supreme Court on March 5th, 2007. The first opinion, in a case called Sinochem International Company versus Malaysia International Shipping Corp., deals with the question of whether or not a court may address and dismiss a case on grounds of forum nonconvenience prior to deciding whether it has jurisdiction over the case. And the second case, called Lance versus Kaufman, deals with the question of whether taxpayers or individual voters have standing to challenge an alleged violation of the Elections Clause. Dealing with the first case, Sinochem, the court in that case addressed the question, quote, whether a district court must conclusively establish its own jurisdiction before dismissing a suit on the ground of forum nonconvenience. The court there, in a unanimous opinion by Justice Ginsburg, answered that question in the negative. No, a court need not conclusively establish its own jurisdiction before dismissing a case on forum nonconvenience ground. In that case, the issue of jurisdiction that was relevant was whether the court had personal jurisdiction over the defendant, the Malaysia International Shipping Corporation. The particular details of the case are not terribly important, other than to note that it addressed allegations of fraud in a judicial proceeding in China, and all of the relevant facts, or virtually all of the relevant facts, occurred in China, took place in the China judicial proceeding, and the notion that it was more convenient to resolve this issue in a Chinese court was fairly straightforward. What the court ultimately held was that usually a court would indeed resolve questions of its own jurisdiction first, but that where its own jurisdiction, particularly its own personal jurisdiction, is not terribly clear or might be difficult or inconvenient to decide, and the issue of forum nonconvenience is fairly clear, and the answer would be to dismiss the case, a court could go ahead and do that. And that seems like a straightforward application of the rule that courts should address non-merits issues in a way that is most convenient to it and to the parties, and to minimize its sort of impact on the parties when its own jurisdiction is in question. The result in this case was not terribly surprising. Forum nonconvenience is a doctrine of convenience that asks which jurisdiction or which forum is in the best position to decide the merits of the case. And because forum nonconvenience itself is a non-merits issue, much like jurisdictional issues, the order in which such non-merit issues gets decided is not terribly important, especially where the answer is that the federal district court is going to be bypassing the merits and disposing of the case, not answering the question on the merits for some reason of its or the party's convenience. In this case, the court said that a district court can bypass subject matter and personal jurisdiction where considerations of convenience, fairness, and judicial economy so warrant, the key being that it's the less burdensome path that the district court took. Now, one might wonder why this case got taken, and the short answer to that is because there was a split in the circuits. A number of courts, relying on some unfortunate dicta in the Supreme Court's earlier decision in Gulf Oil versus Gilbert, had concluded that jurisdictional issues, whether subject matter or personal jurisdiction, necessarily had to be resolved first before a court could reach the question of forum nonconvenience. The trouble, of course, was that in Gilbert, there was no real question of whether or not the court had jurisdiction. The court clearly had personal and subject matter jurisdiction and elected to dismiss the case on forum nonconvenience grounds anyway. So the question being answered by Gilbert was whether a court with jurisdiction could nonetheless decline to hear a case, and the answer to that was yes. In this case, there was some doubt about the court's jurisdiction. So what the court did, quite sensibly, was simply assume it had jurisdiction and dismiss the case anyway, which led to the same exact result, the court declining to hear the case and declining to rule on substantive or law-declaring issues, and sending the case off to be dealt with in a more appropriate form. In making that holding, the court therefore cleaned up the unfortunate wording of some dicta in Gilbert that suggested that jurisdiction had to be handled first, and that made a lot of sense, which is why the court took it, to just clean up what was functionally an overly broad wording of the holding in dicta, the holding in Gilbert, and straighten things up for courts to handle. It's of limited interest to folks who don't deal in international law, but of considerable interest to folks who do deal in international cases and to the sort of management of the court docket and the district court dockets themselves. So the only really interesting question left at the end of Sinochem was whether or not, as is often the case in a forum nonconvenience dismissal, a court that has merely assumed its jurisdiction rather than definitively resolved its jurisdiction can nonetheless condition the dismissal on forum nonconvenience grounds on the defendant waiving any claim or any right to raise a jurisdictional defense in the foreign forum and waiving any statute of limitations that may have run while the case was pending in federal district court. The Supreme Court didn't feel the need to resolve that question here because there was little or no question regarding the jurisdiction of the Chinese courts to hear this case, and there was no suggestion that it would be out of time to raise this in China. But it does leave open an interesting problem. If the court has merely assumed its own personal jurisdiction over the parties, but doesn't necessarily have such jurisdiction and tries to condition a waiver of statute of limitations or jurisdictional objections on the defendant, one wonders whether such a waiver is binding on the defendant. And assuming that they then go into the foreign forum, raise such defenses, and the foreign forum therefore declines to hear the case, could the original plaintiff come back to federal court, federal district court, and say, look, I couldn't go to my alternative forum, therefore the forum nonconvenience dismissal was inappropriate, so please let me back into federal court and proceed to address the jurisdictional question, personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction or what have you. The trouble there, of course, is that while the plaintiff was away in the foreign jurisdiction fighting about matters there, the statute of limitations could have run, any number of things could have happened, and one wonders whether the resumed suit in federal district court would relate back to the original suit if there's a statute of limitations problem, whether there'd be some alternative reason for challenging the district court's authority over the case in that instance simply because of the passage of time. Fortunately, that doesn't have to be resolved at this point, and presumably if it comes up in the future, courts will find some way around that problem, either by making the initial dismissal on forum nonconvenience grounds conditional and thus maintaining some peripheral jurisdiction over it or conditional jurisdiction over it to the extent that it might come back, and not letting that become final until there is indeed an alternative forum that is proved up and available. So that's all that you really have for that. Turning to the second case that we're going to talk about, that is Lance versus Kaufman. That case was decided in a per curiam opinion in which the Supreme Court dismissed the case for lack of standing by the individuals who were challenging the action of the Colorado Supreme Court. The Lance case involved Colorado's sort of unfortunate redistricting efforts after the 2000 census, where the legislature was unable to come together and put forth a redistricting plan, so the Colorado Supreme Court stepped in and decided to do it for them. That led to the question of whether the Colorado Supreme Court's efforts were in violation of the Election Clause of the United States Constitution, which is Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1, which reads that the manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. So given that the legislature has the constitutionally directed responsibility for this, there was considerable doubt whether the Colorado Supreme Court could step in and do it for them. That led to a number of suits, most particularly in the state courts, where after the Colorado Supreme Court did its redistricting plan, the legislature finally got its act together, passed its own competing redistricting plan. The Attorney General of Colorado then challenged the legislative plan, saying that they couldn't pass a new one once they had already passed one through the court because you can only do one per census. Ultimately, the Colorado Supreme Court, not surprisingly, held that its own redistricting plan was the one to go with and that the legislative plan could not be adopted, and strangely enough, sort of decided that it was functionally the legislature in this context, and hence it didn't violate the election clause of the United States Constitution. Ultimately, that decision by the Colorado Supreme Court was denied cert. After that happened, some private citizens brought suit challenging the judicial redistricting plan, and it went into federal district court. It was initially dismissed on the grounds of Rooker-Feldman abstention. That took a direct appeal up to the United States Supreme Court, which vacated and remanded on that question, finding that Rooker-Feldman didn't apply. The district court then went on to hold on remand that the individuals were barred by issue preclusion because they stood in privity with the Secretary of State and the General Assembly, who lost in the earlier version of the case, or the earlier iteration of the case. The one judge concurring decided that the plaintiffs lacked standing in the first place, but in either event, the suit went away. On appeal to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court decided that it agreed with the concurring judge that the plaintiffs lacked standing and dismissed the appeal on those grounds. Interestingly enough, the court observed in a footnote that its earlier decision in the Rooker-Feldman in rejecting the Rooker-Feldman ruling of the district court did not pose a problem in terms of standing because, of course, Rooker-Feldman similarly concerns a court's subject matter jurisdiction, and it doesn't matter which order you deal with with jurisdictional questions, whether they be standing or Rooker-Feldman, just a nice little echo of the Sinochem decision we just discussed. The court's decisions on standing in this case is not terribly surprising. They cite a lot of consistent case law that suggests that any injury that an individual has to show needs to be something more than a generalized injury that would be applicable to any member of the public or any citizen or any voting citizen. And in this case, the objection that the Colorado Supreme Court simply had not followed the law was one of those generalized objections that applies to everyone, and the court decided, therefore, that it did not confer standing on these four individuals who showed no sort of concrete and particularized injury to themselves different from someone else. And so in that sense, this is not a terribly interesting decision. It's a fairly straightforward application of the standing doctrine. What is a little interesting, I guess, is in discussing the standing cases that sort of lead to this conclusion, the court generally talks about them in the context of what seems to be prudential standing. This is not a question of this is literally not a case or controversy. What it is just it's not something that a court ought to get involved in because it seems to be stretching the limits of the judicial power and something that is better handled through the political branches, given that all citizens presumably have a similar interest in seeing the law applied. I'm not sure how sensible that standing doctrine is, but that's certainly how they applied it. But as they were talking about these sort of seemingly prudential aspects of this standing doctrine, the court also went on to note that applying this doctrine sort of ensures that by focusing on a particularized individual injury rather than a more generalized injury from the violation of the law, that the court exercises power that is judicial in nature. And by characterizing it in that way, the court seems to suggest that perhaps things that fall outside the prudential standing doctrine would not be a proper exercise of the judicial power, and hence perhaps not within the court's power at all, if the court has nothing more than the judicial power, which is, of course, what the Constitution grants to the Supreme Court, the judicial power of the United States. So there's sort of a subtle merging, at least, or at least a potentially a subtle confusion regarding whether or not this standing issue is one that is simply prudential by the court, a way of being sort of judicially conservative and not sticking its nose where it's not absolutely needed, or whether it's in fact a formal limitation on the court's power through the word judicial in the Constitution. Again, they never address that. There's just these sort of tea leaf reading in the way the court describes certain cases, one less than dicta, but again, it sort of gives you some hint of the way the court thinks of these things, and I find that a little interesting, a little peculiar. What is also interesting is that as the court describes the sort of lack of individualized injury by the plaintiffs in this case, one wonders whether had similar plaintiffs stepped in and said, look, under the judicial redistricting plan, I'm voting in one district, but under the legislative, the competing legislative redistricting plan, I'd be voting in another district where I would be part of the majority, but I wouldn't be part of the majority under the judicial version, whether that would be enough to allege a more individualized injury on the part of those plaintiffs for whom the redistricting, the differences in the two redistricting plans actually mattered, or whether that would still be too generalized because presumably lots of people in those two districts on the border would have such an injury. And that, of course, will be left for a separate day. These plaintiffs don't appear to have alleged any of that. They just alleged a law violation, and that was it. Anyway, so once again, not a monumental case of primary interest only because the underlying decisions were so strange and bizarre, with the Colorado Supreme Court sort of taking a legislative role for itself. But that's the state courts for you. So that was the end of today's edition of SCOTUS Cast. I hope you found these cases at least somewhat interesting, particularly if you're sort of a federal courts or federal jurisdiction maven. They are at least a little more interesting. And if not, at least hopefully they were educational. Thank you again. This is Eric Jaffe, and until next time.